2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
She was tear-gassed and beaten.
Images of thousands desperate to escape Taliban oppression filled our news feeds. More than 80,000 Afghans made it to America. But the story didn't end there.
It was very cold. There was no power, no heat.
Who would help our newest neighbors? I'm Andrea Smartin. In Stranger Becomes Neighbor, you'll hear the stories of some remarkable refugees who left their homes and their dreams behind, only to start over from zero.
Their only possession was three blankets.
And you'll meet Americans who stepped up to help them.
You want me to come when you deliver your baby.
What can one person do in the face of an international disaster decades in the making? That's Stranger Becomes Neighbor. Find us at kslpodcast.com, follow us on Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else you listen.
This is Religion Today with Martin Tanner, a weekly look at religion and spirituality here at home and around the world. Now, here's your host, Martin Tanner.
Welcome. This is Religion Today. I'm your host, Martin Tanner. It is my great pleasure today to have as a guest on Religion Today, Dr. Bruce Grayson, who's Professor Emeritus of Psychiatry and Neurobehavioral Sciences at the University of Virginia School of Medicine. He's a guy who's done an amazing amount of things. He was director of the Division of Perceptual Studies at the University of Virginia. He co-founded IONS, where he was the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Near-Death Studies. He's received numerous awards, published a whole bunch of scholarly articles and books, and it's been my great pleasure to interview him from time to time in the past and to run into him occasionally at the annual IONS conferences. Today, he's here to talk to us about his new book, After, A-F-T-E-R, just like it sounds, which I very much enjoyed. Welcome to Religion Today, Dr. Bruce Grayson.
Thank you, Martin. I'm delighted to be here with you today.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time. This is a wonderful book. It's about near-death experiences. You've written about this topic many, many times. Why did you write this book?
Well, all that I've written in the past has been for an academic audience, mostly a medical audience. And it's not that interesting, frankly, because it's been written in medicalese. And I thought that it was time to bring this information to the general public. So this is my first book that's been written for a lay audience, people who don't have a technical background. And the reason I did it now is that after all these years, I think we finally understand enough about near-death experiences and enough about how the brain works in order to be able to say meaningful things about them.
One of the things that is so fascinating to me and has been over the years about studying near-death experiences is how profoundly they affect the people who have them. Talk about that right up front here.
Right. Well, that also impresses me most as a psychiatrist, because I spend my living, my living is trying to help people make changes in their lives, and it's very difficult work, and we make only small changes. And here you have this experience, which in a matter of seconds or minutes totally transforms someone's attitudes, beliefs, values, and behavior. I know of no other experience that has that type of power. And this, to me, is one of the main arguments why near-death experiences are not hallucinations or delusions. Hallucinations do not make people change their turn their lives around. I've seen everyone becomes more spiritual after an NDE, become much less invested in material goods, power, prestige, fame, and much more altruistic, compassionate, caring about others, caring about relationships rather than things. And this is often good for them, but it's often difficult for them as well. They may have to change their careers. I've known people who were career military officers or career policemen who just could not imagine shooting somebody after a near-death experience. They come back thinking we're all interconnected, and the golden rule is not just a guideline that we're supposed to follow, but it's the law of nature, like gravity. And when you hurt someone else, you hurt yourself. When you help someone else, you help yourself. So the idea of shooting someone is just totally unthinkable. And they often go back to school and retrain in the helping professions, clergy, healthcare, teaching, social work, and so forth.
This book that you have written has a number of case studies of experiencers who describe what happened to them, sort of interwoven with different points that you would like to make. You have, I'm sure, read and heard firsthand thousands by now of near-death experiences. Yeah. How did you go about choosing the ones for this book?
Well, I chose ones that I had the most information about and the ones that illustrated certain points. For example, I wanted a case that illustrated someone who left their body and accurately described things that they could not have imagined if they hadn't actually seen it from an out-of-body perspective. I'll give you an example of that. A 55-year-old fellow who was admitted to the emergency room with chest pain and had emergency quadruple bypass surgery. And in the middle of this operation, he claimed to have left his body. And from watching above, he saw his surgeon, as he described it, flapping his elbows as if he was trying to fly. Now, at the time he told me this, I've been a doctor for about 30 years, and I had never seen or heard anything like this. I thought, this is not possible. He's got to be hallucinating. But with his permission, I then talked to his surgeon after the operation was over. And the surgeon admitted this was correct, that he had developed this strange habit that he'd never seen anyone else use. He would let his assistant start the operation, and he would get his sterile gown and gloves on, and then come into the operating room and supervise them. And he didn't want to risk touching anything that wasn't in a sterile field with his hands, so he placed his hands where he knew they wouldn't touch anything, flat against his chest, palms against his chest. And then he'd point things out to them with his elbows so he wouldn't touch anything with his fingers. And he demonstrated for me, it's just like he was flapping his arms. And I don't know how the patient could have known about that unless he'd actually seen it.
That is a great story. You give a similar kind of an account up front in your introduction about a young lady who saw a stain. It's similar kind of a thing. I'm surprised that in view of those two and many, many other examples, that you would still hold out some possibility that this is purely from the mind, or is that a statement in your book here to be absolutely neutral?
Well, I think it is. I want to distinguish between the mind and the brain. It is not caused by the brain. There's no way we have of explaining this in terms of physiological mechanisms. However, there's no way we can explain normal everyday thinking in terms of physiological mechanisms. We have no way of understanding how a chemical or electrical property in the brain can produce a thought. So it certainly can't produce a thought from an out-of-body perspective. But I think there are physiological mechanisms in the brain that allow our consciousness to leave the body and see things from another perspective. And I think some of those things happen during our near-death event when the brain's sort of control over the mind breaks down and the mind is free to roam without the brain controlling it.
We are speaking with Dr. Bruce Grayson, who's the author of a new book called After, which I highly recommend. It has some fascinating accounts of near-death experiences in it. And it also has some scholarly and yet understandable for the general public discussions about what they mean. We've got a couple of minutes before our first break here, Dr. Grayson. Maybe we could talk about a few of the experiences that you have in the book. Just give some highlights about them.
Well, one of them involves someone who saw a deceased person in his near-death experience, and that's usually dismissed by skeptics as being wishful thinking and, expectation. And this fellow had been admitted to the hospital with severe pneumonia, and he had one nurse who was working with him every day. And one day she told him she was going to be taking a long weekend off, and there'd be other nurses working with him, so he said goodbye to her. After she left, he had a respiratory arrest, couldn't breathe, had to be resuscitated, and had a near-death experience in which she met this nurse, Anita. He was stunned to see her there and asked her what she's doing there. And she said, "You can't stay here. You have to go back and tell my parents that I'm sorry I wrecked the red MGB." He then woke up back in his body in the hospital bed with full memory of this. and he told the first nurse who walked into his room about this experience. She got very upset and walked out of the room immediately. He later found out that this nurse, his favorite nurse, had taken the weekend off to celebrate her 21st birthday, and her parents surprised her with a red MGB for her birthday. She got in the car, took off for a spin, lost control, smashed into a telephone pole, and died instantly. There's no way he could have known that or expected her to die. Certainly no way he could have known how she died, and yet he did.
Fascinating story. And these are the kinds of things that we hear. People learn information they did not know. We're speaking with Dr. Bruce Grayson, a professor emeritus of psychiatry and neurobehavioral sciences at the University of Virginia School of Medicine. He's co-founder of a new book called After, which is a fascinating, fabulous book, which I highly recommend. We will be right back with more about his book. Stay tuned. I'm Martin Tanner. This is Religion Today.
Religion Today with Martin Tanner continues on KSL News Radio 102.7 FM and 1160 AM.
We're back. I'm Martin Tanner. This is Religion Today. It's my great pleasure to again mention that my guest today is Dr. Bruce Grayson, who has written a new book about near-death experiences. And Bruce Grayson has been with this near-death experience phenomenon that has grown and grown and grown since the beginning. He was there at the time of Raymond Moody, there at the time of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and George Ritchie, who is now gone, and many, many others. And so, again, it's a great delight to have you here. Thank you so much for being here to tell us about your book, After.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Martin.
You're certainly welcome. Let's talk during this last segment about a few more of the case studies or experiences that you include in your book and about why they're there and what you hope to convey.
Well, let me talk a bit about the life review. Many death experience say that they review their entire lives, often in exquisite detail, more than their memories could account for. And occasionally, we have people say that they relive these events in their lives, not only through their own eyes, but through the eyes of other people involved in the incidents. Now, I'll give you an example of that. This was a fellow named Tom Sawyer, that's his real name, who in his 30s was working under a truck in his driveway, and the truck fell and crushed his chest. He had a near-death experience in which he had a very vivid life review, and in one incident in that review, he remembered being a teenager driving his hot rod truck down the street, and a drunk man ran out in front of his truck. He jammed on the brakes, was furious because the guy almost dented his truck. So he rolled down the window and started yelling at the man. And the man, unfortunately being too drunk, reached his hand in the window and slapped Tom across the face. Well, that was just too much for this high-headed teenager. So he got out of the truck and started beating the man mercilessly and left him a bloody mess on the median, and then got back in his truck and drove away. Well, when he had his life reviewed this, he relived the entire experience through his own eyes, feeling the rage and the adrenaline rush, but also through the eyes of the drunk man, feeling the humiliation, the embarrassment of being beaten up by this teenager, feeling his nose getting bloody, feeling his teeth going through his lower lip. And Tom came back from this experience realizing that we're all in this together, that you can't separate one person from another, and that when you hurt somebody else, you're hurting yourself as well. He experienced all this through the other man's eyes. And I hear this again and again from near-death experiencers, that they come back realizing that we're all part of the same thing, and we're all part of the same divinity. They feel totally connected to other people, to nature, to the divine, and they feel like they can see the divine in everybody else, which totally transforms how they treat other people, how they become much more altruistic than they had been before.
One, and this seems to be one of the great purposes of near-death experiences, is to have this review and perhaps to learn more about altruism. One of the points that you made earlier in the show with me was the distinction between the mind and the brain. Talk a little bit about that so that our listeners can understand that.
Right. Well, we usually think that the mind is simply what the brain does, and we're kind of taught that the brain creates all our thoughts and feelings and perceptions. And in everyday life, that seems to be true. When you get hit on the head, you don't think very clearly. When you get intoxicated, that affects your thinking. So it seems as if the mind is created by the brain, and yet we have experiences like near-death experiences where the brain seems to be shutting down. Sometimes it goes completely flatlined, no activity at all, and yet the mind is going better than ever. People report that their experiences during an NDE are more vivid and clearer and faster than ever before, and yet there's no brain activity going on. So it seems like in those circumstances, the mind is separated from the brain. Even though it seems connected in daily life, under these exceptional circumstances, it can free itself from the brain and function without the limitations the brain puts on it. This may sound radical, but it's not by any means a new idea. Hippocrates wrote about this 2,000 years ago. He called the brain the interpreter of the mind.
And I think this is a wonderful point, because although you're discussing this from a scientific point of view, this should give great hope to people who have questions about, you know, religion or an afterlife or a belief in an afterlife, because this is not absolute proof, but strong evidence that there's a survival beyond the physical death.
That's right. That's right. If the mind can function without the brain during life, it can function maybe after death without the brain. And that seems to be what's happening from the evidence of NDEs and other phenomena as well, that when the brain is shutting down, that frees up the mind to function more fully.
In some ways, the physical body seems to be an impediment to full function of the mind, not an enhancement to it, at least in earthly life.
That's right. That's right. The body, including the brain, evolved to help us negotiate in the physical world. And that puts severe limits on what the mind can do in the body, because the brain kind of filters out everything that's not related to surviving in the physical world. Things like seeing deceased loved ones, communicating with God. These are things that are not essential to finding food and shelter and a mate. But when the brain stops putting these limits on us, the mind can go ahead and experience all these things.
Share another experience or two from your book, if you don't mind.
Sure. Well, one fellow I knew was a Marine sergeant. I knew him before that. He was a high school bully and was a very macho guy. His career goal was to become a Marine, and he did that. And he served in Vietnam. And at one point, he was shot in the chest and had shrapnel all through his lungs. He was air-evac'd to a hospital in the Philippines, where they did an extensive operation to clear the stuff out of his lungs. And during that operation, he had a near-death experience. And when he came back from that experience, he just couldn't imagine trying to shoot somebody, and yet that was his job. He was sent back to Vietnam after rehabilitation and tried to lead his platoon, but found he couldn't shoot. So he had to leave the Marines, which had been his lifelong goal. And he came back to the States and retrained as a medical technician. And now he helps other people with his career rather than hurting people. Now, these things sound like they're beneficial, but the family often has a hard time dealing with this. For example, this fellow, he lived in Connecticut, and we heard about the 9/11 disaster. He just took off and went down to New York to see if he could help, leaving his family saying, you know, what's the matter with us? You're just leaving us here. And it's particularly hard for children of near-death experiencers who feel that now their parent loves everyone as much as they love the child, and they feel very offended and abused by that. So it can be difficult. I've seen people's marriages fall apart after a near-death experience, and careers fall apart.
Whenever someone you're used to changes so dramatically, it can sometimes have serious consequences, even if the change is good from the perception
That's
of the
right.
person who has them.
That's right. It's as if one member of a marriage has a sudden religious conversion and the other one doesn't. It's very difficult.
Actually, that's a perfect analogy. If somebody finds religion or finds God, that's a huge change, and
yes,
it often doesn't
yes.
work well for a spouse. Great, great
right.
analogy. You have a chapter about God. The show's Religion Today. I would be
right,
remiss
right.
if I didn't ask about that chapter.
Sure, sure. Well, the vast majority of people who have a near-death experience talk about seeing this warm, loving being of light that makes them feel safe and protected and unconditionally loved. And many people here in the West will call this God. I've talked to people who are Hindus and Buddhists in Asia. They don't use that word, but they describe the same phenomenon. So what is this? People will say to me here, I'm going to use the word God to describe this, so you know what I'm talking about. But it wasn't exactly the God I was taught about in church. It's much bigger than that. But I don't know what else to call it. So it's something that they sense is divine, and that is made of the same material they're made of. They liken it to being a wave in the ocean. The wave is distinct from the ocean, but it's made of the same material. And that's the way they relate to this divinity, that I'm the same stuff as this divine is, but just a tiny, tiny part of it.
Which to me is just a wonderful, wonderful message for all of us, that we have a spark of the divine there.
Yes.
We are out of time. Dr. Bruce Grayson, thank you so much for sharing your time with us to talk about your new book, After, which for our listeners, I think is wonderful and highly recommend.
Thank you so much, Martin.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
There's desperation and anguish.
More than 80,000 Afghans have since arrived in America. But this story is still unfolding. I'm Andrea Martin. In my new podcast, Stranger Becomes Neighbor, we'll find out what happens to these new arrivals in our communities. Who would help our newest neighbors? Follow us at kslpodcast.com, Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else you listen.